similarity between my voice and my appearance made him cautious, because he swallowed the instant retort that came to his lips.
"Yes, it is," he said shortly instead.
"William, Viscount Ashness, 9th Earl of Ellesmere." "All that," I said politely. "Gracious." I took hold of one leech between thumb and forefinger and pulled gently. The thing stretched out like a thick rubber band, but declined to let go. The boy's pale flesh pulled out too, and he made a small choking sound.
"Let go," he said. "It'll break. You'll break it."
"Could do," I admitted. I got to my feet and shook down my skirts, putting myself in better order. "Come along," I said, offering him a hand. "I'll take you to the house. If I sprinkle a bit of salt on them, they'll drop off at once." He refused the hand, but got to his feet a little shakily. He glanced around as though looking for someone. "Papa," he explained, seeing my expression.
"We missed the way, and he told me to wait by the stream while he made sure of our direction. I shouldn't like him to take alarm if I'm not here when he returns."
"I shouldn't worry," I said. "I imagine he'll have found the house himself by this time. It isn't far." A fair guess, as it was the only house in some distance, and at the end of a well-marked trail. Lord John had plainly left the boy while he went ahead to find Jamie and warn him. Very thoughtful. My lips tightened involuntarily.
"Will that be Fraser's?" the boy asked.
He took a ginger step, spraddling so as not to allow his legs to rub together.
"We had come to see a James Fraser."
"I'm Mrs. Fraser," I said, and smiled at him. "Your stepmother," I might have added, but didn't. "Come along." He followed me through the scrim of trees toward the house, almost treading on my heels in his haste. I kept tripping over tree roots and half-bedded stones, not watching where I was going, fighting the overwhelming urge to turn around and stare at him. If William Viscount Ashness, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, was not the very last person I had ever expected to see in the backwoods of North Carolina, he was certainly next to the last. King George was a trifle less likely to turn up on the doorstep, I suppose. But what had possessed that? I groped about, trying to choose among several discreditable epithets to apply to Lord John Grey, and gave up the struggle in favour of trying to think what in heaven's name to do. I gave that up, too. There wasn't a thing I could do. William Viscount Ashness, 9th Earl of Ellesmere. Or he thought he was. "And just what do you propose to do?" I thought silently and savagely toward Lord John Grey, when he finds out that he's really the bastard son of a pardoned Scottish criminal. And, more important, what's the Scottish criminal going to do? Or feel? I stopped, causing the boy to stumble as he tried to avoid crashing into me. "Sorry," I murmured, "thought I saw a snake," and went on. The thought that had stopped me in my tracks, still knotting my midsection like a dose of bitter apples. Could Lord John have brought the boy on purpose to reveal his parentage? Did he mean to leave him here, with Jamie, with us? Alarming as I found the notion, I couldn't reconcile it with the man I had met in Jamaica. I might have sound reasons for disliking John Grey. Always difficult to feel a warm sense of goodwill toward a man with a professed homosexual passion for one's husband, after all. But I had to admit that I had seen no trace of either recklessness or cruelty in his character. On the contrary, he had struck me as a sensitive, kindly, and honourable man. Or at least he had, before I'd found out about his predilections towards Jamie. Could something have happened? Some threat to the boy that made Lord John fear for his safety? Surely no one could have found out the truth about William. No one knew, save Lord John and Jamie. And me, of course, I added as an afterthought. Without the evidence of the resemblance, again I repressed the urge to turn round and stare at him. There was no reason for anyone ever to suspect. But see them side by side, and, well, I shortly would see them side by side. The thought gave me a queer hollowness beneath the breastbone, half fright and half anticipation. Was it really as strong as I thought, that resemblance? I took a deliberate quick detour through a clump of low-hanging dogwood, making an excuse to turn and wait for him. He came through after me, ducking awkwardly to retrieve the silver-buckled shoe he had dropped. No, I thought, watching covertly as he straightened up, face flushed from bending. It wasn't as strong as I'd thought at first. He had the promise of Jamie's bones, but it wasn't all there yet. He had the outlines, but not yet the substance. He would be very tall, that was obvious, but now he was about my height, gawky and slender, his limbs very long, and thin enough to seem almost delicate. He was much darker than Jamie, too. While his hair glinted red in the shafts of sunlight that came through the branches, it was a deep chestnut, nothing like Jamie's bright red gold, and his skin had turned a soft golden brown in the sun, not at all like Jamie's half-burnt bronze. He had the Fraser's slanted cat eyes, though, and there was something about the set of his head, the cock of the slender shoulders, that made me think of... Bree. It hit me with a small shock like a spark of electricity. He did look quite a bit like Jamie, but it was my memories of Brianna that had caused that jolt of instant recognition when I saw him. Only 10 years her junior, the childish outlines of his face were much more similar to hers than to Jamie's. He had paused to disentangle a long strand of hair from a grappling dogwood branch. Now he came up with me, one brow raised inquiringly. "Is it far?" he asked. The colour had come back to his face with the exertion of walking, but he still looked a trifle sick and kept his eyes averted from his legs. "No," I said. I motioned toward the chestnut grove. "Just there. Look, you can see the smoke from the chimney." He didn't wait to be led, but set off with dogged speed, anxious to be rid of the leeches. I followed him quickly, not wanting him to reach the cabin ahead of me. I was prey to a mixture of the most disquieting sensations. Uppermost was anxiety for Jamie, a little lower, anger at John Gray. Below that, an intense curiosity. And at the bottom, far enough down that I could almost pretend it wasn't there, was a pang of sharp longing for my daughter, whose face I had never thought to see again. Jamie and Lord John were sitting on the bench by the door. At the sound of our steps, Jamie rose and looked toward the wood. He'd had time to prepare himself. His glance passed casually over the boy as he turned to me.
"All clear. You've found the other of our visitors, then. I'd sent Ian down to find you. You'll recall Lord John, I expect."
"How could I forget?" I said, giving his lordship a particularly bright smile. His mouth twitched slightly, but he kept a straight face as he bowed deeply in my direction. How did a man stay so impeccably groomed after several days on horseback, sleeping in the woods?
"Your servant, Mrs. Fraser."
He glanced at the boy, frowning slightly at his state of undress.
"May I present my stepson, Lord Ellesmere? And William, as I see you have made the acquaintance of our gracious hostess, will you also make your compliments to our host, Captain Fraser?"
The boy was shifting from foot to foot, nearly dancing on his toes. At this prompting, though, he jerked a quick bow in Jamie's direction.
"Your servant, Captain," he said,
then cast an agonized glance at me, plainly conscious of nothing but the fact that more of his blood was being sucked out by the second. "You'll excuse us," I said politely, and taking the boy by the arm, led him into the cabin and shut the door firmly in the astonished faces of the men. William sat immediately on the stool I pointed out and thrust out his legs, trembling.
"Hurry," he said. "Oh, please do hurry."
There was no salt ground. I took my digging knife and chipped a piece from the block with reckless haste, dropped it into my mortar, and smashed it into granules with a few quick jabs of the pestle. Crumbling the grains between my fingers, I scattered the salt thickly on each leech.
"Rather hard on the poor old leeches," I said, seeing the first draw itself slowly up into a ball. "Still, it does the trick."
The leech let go its grip and tumbled off William's leg, followed in similar fashion by its fellows, who writhed in slow-motion agony on the floor. I scooped up the tiny bodies and flung them into the fire, then knelt in front of him, tactfully keeping my head bent while he got control of his face.
"Here, let me take care of the bites."
Tiny streams of blood ran down his legs. I dabbed them with a clean cloth, then washed the small wounds with vinegar and St. John's wort to stop the bleeding. He let out a deep and tremulous sigh of relief as I dried his shins.
"It's not that I'm afraid of blood," he said,
in a tone of bravado that made it apparent that that was precisely what he was afraid of.
"It's only they're such filthy creatures."
"Nasty little things," I agreed. I stood up, took a clean cloth, dipped it in water, and matter-of-factly wiped his smudged face. Then, without asking, I picked up my hairbrush and began to comb out the snarls of his hair. He looked utterly startled at this familiarity, but beyond an initial stiffening of his spine, made no protest. And as I began to order his hair, he let out another small sigh and let his shoulders slump a little. His skin had a pleasant animal heat, and my fingers, still chilly from the stream, warmed comfortably as I ordered the soft strands of silky chestnut hair. It was very thick and slightly wavy. On the crown of his head was a cowlick, a delicate wall that gave me mild vertigo to see. Jamie had the same cowlick in the same place.
"I've lost my ribbon," he said,
looking vaguely round, as though one might materialize from bread hutch or inkwell.
"That's all right. I'll lend you one."
I had finished plaiting his hair and tied it with a scrap of yellow ribbon, feeling as I did so an odd sense of protectiveness. I had learned of his existence only a few years earlier, and if I had thought of him in the meantime at all, had felt no more than a minor sense of curiosity tinged with resentment. But now something, be it his resemblance to my own child, his resemblance to Jamie, or simply the fact that I had taken care of him in some small way, had given me a strange feeling of almost proprietary concern for him. I could hear the rumble of voices outside, the sound of a sudden laugh, and my annoyance at John Gray came back with a rush. How dare he risk both Jamie and William? And for what? Why was the bloody man here, in a wilderness as blatantly unsuited to someone of his sort as a... The door opened, and Jamie poked his head in.
"Will you be all right?" he asked.
His eyes rested on the boy, an expression of polite concern on his face, but I saw his hand curled tight as it rested on the doorframe, and the line of tension that ran through leg and shoulder. He was strung like a harp. If I had touched him, he would have given off a low twanging noise.
"Quite all right," I said pleasantly. "Would Lord John care for some refreshment, do you think?"
I put the kettle on to boil for tea, and, with an inner sigh, took out the last loaf of bread which I had meant to use for my next round of penicillin experiments. Feeling that the emergency justified it, I brought out the last bottle of brandy as well. Then I put the jam pot on the table, explaining that the butter was unfortunately in the custody of the pig at the moment.
"Pig?" said William, looking confused. "In the pantry," I said, with a nod at the closed door. "Why do you keep—"
he started, then sat up sharply and closed his mouth, having obviously been kicked under the table by his stepfather, who was smiling pleasantly over his cup.
"It is very kind of you to receive us, Mrs. Fraser," Lord John interjected, giving his stepson a warning eye. "I do apologize for our unexpected arrival. I hope we do not discommode you too greatly."
"Not at all," I said, wondering just where we were going to put them to sleep. William could go to the shed with Ian, I supposed. It was no worse than sleeping rough, as he had been doing. But the thought of sharing a bed with Jamie, with Lord John on the trundle an arm's length away, Ian, with his usual instinct for mealtimes, appeared at this delicate point in the proceedings and was introduced all round. With such a confusion of explanations and reciprocal bowing in cramped quarters, that the teapot was knocked over. Using this minor disaster as an excuse, I sent Ian off to show William the attractions of wood and stream, with a packet of jam sandwiches and a bottle of cider to share between them. Then, free of their inhibiting presences, I filled the cups with brandy, sat down again, and fixed John Gray with a narrow eye. "What are you doing here?" I said without preamble. He opened his light blue eyes very wide, then lowered his very long lashes and batted them deliberately at me.
"I did not come with the intention of seducing your husband, I assure you," he said.
"John!" Jamie's fist struck the table with a force that rattled the teacups. His cheekbones were flushed dark red, and he was scowling with embarrassed fury.
"Sorry."
Gray, by contrast, had gone white, though he remained otherwise visibly unruffled. It occurred to me for the first time that he might possibly be as unnerved as Jamie by this meeting.
"My apologies, ma'am," he said, with a curt nod in my direction. "That was unforgivable. I would point out, however, that you have been looking at me since we met as though you had encountered me lying in the gutter outside some notorious Molly house."
A light flush burned over his face now, too. "Sorry," I breathed. "Give me a bit more notice next time, and I'll take care to adjust my features." He stood up suddenly and went to the window, where he stood with his back to the room, hands braced on the sill. There was an exceedingly awkward silence. I didn't want to look at Jamie. Instead, I affected great interest in a bottle of fennel seeds that stood on the table.
"My wife has died," he said abruptly, "on the ship between England and Jamaica. She was coming to join me there."
"I'm sorry to hear of it," Jamie said quietly.
"The lad will have been with her."
"Yes."
Lord John turned back, leaning against the sill so that the spring sunlight silhouetted his neat head and gave him a gleaming halo.
"Willie was very close to Isabel. She was the only mother he'd known since his birth."
Willie's true mother, Geneva Dunsany, had died in giving birth to him. His presumed father, the Earl of Ellesmere, had died the same day in an accident. So much Jamie had already told me. Likewise, that Geneva's sister Isabel had taken care of the orphan boy, and that John Gray had married Isabel when Willie was 6 or so, at the time Jamie had left the Dunsany's employ. "I'm very sorry," I said sincerely, and didn't mean only the death of his wife. Gray glanced at me and gave me the shadow of a nod in acknowledgement.
"My appointment as governor was nearly at an end. I had intended perhaps to take up residence on the island, should the climate suit my family. As it was..."
He shrugged.
"Willie was grief-stricken by the loss of his mother. It seemed advisable to seek to distract his mind by whatever means I could. An opportunity presented itself almost at once. My wife's estate includes a large property in Virginia, which she had bequeathed to William. Upon her death, I received inquiries from the factor of the plantation, asking for instruction."
He moved away from the window, coming slowly back toward the table where we sat.
"I couldn't well decide what to do with the property without seeing it and evaluating the conditions that obtain here. So I determined that we should sail to Charleston and from there travel overland to Virginia. I trusted to the novelty of the experience to divert William from his grief, which I am pleased to observe it seems to have done. He has been much more cheerful these past weeks."
I opened my mouth to say that Fraser's Ridge seemed a bit out of his way, regardless, but then thought better of it. He appeared to guess what I was thinking, for he gave me a brief wry smile. I really would have to do something about my face, I thought. Having Jamie read my thoughts was one thing, and not at all unpleasant, on the whole. Having total strangers walk in and out of my mind at will was something else.
"Where is the plantation?"
Jamie asked, with somewhat more tact but the same implication.
The nearest town of any sort is called Lynchburg on the James River.
Lord John looked at me, still wry, but apparent good humour restored.
It is, in fact, no more than a few days' deviation in our journey to come here, in spite of the remoteness of your eyrie.
He switched his attention to Jamie, frowning slightly.
I told Willie that you were an old acquaintance of mine, from my soldiering days. I trust you do not object to the deception.
Jamie shook his head, one side of his mouth turning up a bit.
Deception, is it? I shouldn't think I could well mind what you called me, under the circumstances.
And so far as that bit goes, it's true enough.
You don't think he'll remember you? I asked Jamie. He had been a groom on Willie's home estate, a prisoner of war following the Jacobite Rising. He hesitated, but then shook his head.
I dunna think so. He was barely six when I left Hellwater. That will be half a lifetime ago to a lad, and a world away. And there's no reason he should think to recall a groom named Mackenzie, let alone connect the name with me.
Willie hadn't recognised Jamie on sight, certainly, but then he'd been too concerned with the leeches to take much notice of anyone. A thought struck me, and I turned to Lord John, who was fiddling with a snuff-box he had taken from his pocket. "Tell me," I said, moved by a sudden impulse. "I don't mean to distress you, but do you know how your wife died?"
"How?"
He looked startled at the question, but collected himself at once.
"She died of a bloody flux, so her maid said."
His mouth twisted slightly.
"It was not a pleasant death, I believe."
Bloody flux, eh? That was the standard description for anything from amoebic dysentery to cholera. "Was there a doctor, someone on board who took care of her?"
"There was,"
he said, a little sharply.
"What do you imply, ma'am?"
"Nothing," I said. "It's only that I wondered whether perhaps that was where Willie saw leeches used." A flicker of understanding crossed his face.
"Oh, I see. I hadn't thought..."
At this point, I noticed Ian, who was hovering in the doorway, obviously reluctant to interrupt, but with a marked look of urgency on his face.
"Did you want something, Ian?"
I asked, interrupting Lord John. He shook his head, brown hair flying.
"No, I thank you, Auntie. It's only..."
He cast a helpless glance at Jamie.
"Well, I'm sorry, Uncle. I ken I shouldn't know how let him do it, but..."
"What?"
Alarmed by Ian's tone of voice, Jamie was already on his feet.
"What have you done?"
The lad twisted his big hands together, cracking his knuckles in embarrassment.
"Well, you see, his lordship asked for the privy, and so I told him about the snake, and that he'd best go into the wood instead. So he did, but then he wanted to see the snake, and...
"He's not bitten?"
Jamie asked anxiously. Lord John, who had obviously been about to ask the same thing, gave him a glance.
"Oh, no!"
Ian looked surprised.
"We couldn't see it to start with, because it was too dark below. So we lifted off the bench top to get more light. We could see the serpent fine then, and we poked at it a bit wi' a long branch, so it was lashing to and fro like the wee book said, but it didn't seem inclined to bite itself. And...
He darted a glance at Lord John, and swallowed audibly.
"It was my fault,"
he said, nobly squaring his shoulders the better to accept blame.
"I said as how I'd thought to shoot it earlier, but we didn't want to waste the powder. And so, as lordship said, as how he would fetch his papa's pistol from the saddlebag and deal with the thing at once. And so..."
"Ian," said Jamie between his teeth, "stop blethering this instant and tell me straight what you've done with the lad. You've not shot him by mistake, I hope."
Ian looked offended at this slur upon his marksmanship.
"Of course not," he said.
Lord John coughed politely, forestalling further recriminations.
"Perhaps you would be good enough to tell me the whereabouts of my son at this moment?"
Ian took a deep breath, and visibly commended his soul to God,
"'He's in the bottom of the privy,' he said. "'Have you got a bit of rope, Uncle Jamie?'
With an admirable economy of both words and motion, Jamie reached the door in two strides and disappeared, closely followed by Lord John.
"'Is he in there with the snake?' I asked, hastily scrabbling through the wash-basket for something to use as a tourniquet, just in case.
"'Oh, no, Auntie,' Ian assured me. "'You didn't think I'd have left him and the serpent was still there. "'Maybe I'd best go help,' he added, and disappeared as well.
I hurried after him to find Jamie and Lord John standing shoulder to shoulder in the doorway of the privy, conversing with the depths. Standing on tiptoe to peer over Lord John's shoulder, I saw the torn butt-end of a long, slender hickory branch protruding a few inches above the edge of the oblong hole. I held my breath. Lord Ellesmere's struggles had stirred up the contents of the privy, and the reek was enough to sear the cilia off my nasal membranes.
"'He says he's not hurt,' Jamie assured me, turning away from the hole and unlimbering a coil of rope from his shoulder.
"'Good,' I said. "'Where's the snake, though?'
I peeked nervously into the outhouse, but couldn't see anything beyond the silvery cedar boards and the dark recesses of the pit.
"'It went that way,'
Ian said, gesturing vaguely down the path by which I had come.
"'A laddie couldn't quite get a clear shot, so I gave the thing a wee snoove with a stick, and damned if the bugger didn't turn and come at me, right up the branch. It scared me so I let out a skellach and let go, and I bumped the lad and, well, that's how it happened,'
he ended lamely. Trying to avoid Jamie's eye, he sidled toward the pit, and leaning over, yelled awkwardly,
"'Hey, I'm glad you didn't break your neck.'
Jamie gave him a look that said rather plainly that if necks were to be broken, but forbore further remarks in the interests of extracting William promptly from his oubliette. This procedure was carried out without further incident, and the would-be marksman was lifted out, clinging to the rope like a caterpillar on a string. There had luckily been enough sewage in the bottom of the pit to break his fall. From appearances, the 9th Earl of Ellesmere had landed face down. Lord John stood for a moment on the path, wiping his hands on his breeches, and surveying the encrusted object before him. He rubbed the back of a hand over his mouth, trying either to hide a smile or to stifle his sense of smell. Then his shoulders started to shake.
"'What news from the underworld, Persephone?' he said, unable to keep the quaver of laughter out of his voice.
A pair of slanted eyes looked blue murder out of the mask of filth obscuring his lordship's features. It was a thoroughly Fraser expression, and I felt a qualm go through me at the sight. By my side, Ian gave a sudden start. He glanced quickly from the Earl to Jamie and back, and then he caught my eye, and his own face went perfectly and unnaturally blank. Jamie was saying something in Greek, to which Lord John replied in the same language, whereupon both men laughed like loons. Trying to ignore Ian, I bent an eye in Jamie's direction. Shoulders still shaking with suppressed mirth, he saw fit to enlighten me.
"'Epicharmus,' he explained, "'at the Oracle of Delphi, seekers after enlightenment would throw down a dead python into the pit, and then hang about, breathing in the fumes as it decayed.
Lord John declaimed, gesturing grandly,
"'The spirit toward the heavens, the body to the earth.'
William exhaled strongly through his nose, precisely as Jamie did when tried beyond bearing. Ian twitched beside me. "'Good grief,' I thought, freshly unnerved. "'Does the boy have nothing from his mother?'
"'And have you attained any spiritual insights as a result of your recent mystical experience, William?'
Lord John asked, making a poor attempt at self-control. He and Jamie were both flushed, with a laughter that I thought due as much to the release of nervous tension as to brandy or hilarity. His lordship, glowering, pulled off his neckcloth and flung it on the path with a soggy splat. Now Ian was giggling nervously too, unable to help himself. My own belly muscles were quivering under the strain, but I could see that the patches of exposed flesh above William's collar were the colour of the ripe tomatoes by the privy. Knowing all too well what usually happened to a Fraser who reached that particular level of incandescence, I thought the time had come to break up the party.
"Ahem," I said, clearing my throat.
"If you will allow me, gentlemen, unlearned as I am in Greek philosophy, there is one small epigram I know by heart."
I handed William the jar of lye soap I had brought in lieu of a tourniquet.
"Pindar," I said. "Water is best." A small flash of what might have been gratitude showed through the muck. His lordship bowed to me with utmost correctness, then turned, gave Ian a fishy stare, and stomped off through the grass towards the creek, dripping. He seemed to have lost his shoes.
"Poor clarty bugger," Ian said, shaking his head mournfully. "It'll be days before he gets the stink off."
"No doubt." Lord John's lips were still twitching, but the urge to declaim Greek poetry seemed to have left him, replaced by less elevated concerns.
"Do you know what has become of my pistol, by the way? The one William was using before his unfortunate accident?"
"Oh."
Ian looked uncomfortable. He lifted his chin in the direction of the privy.
I'm very much afraid."
"I see."
Lord John rubbed his own immaculately barbered chin. Jamie fixed Ian with a long stare.
"'Said
Ian, backing up a pace or two.
"'Get it,'
said Jamie, in a tone that brooked no contradiction.
"'But,'
said Ian.
"'No,'
said his uncle, and dropped the slimy rope at his feet. Ian's Adam's apple bobbed once. He looked at me, wide-eyed as a rabbit.
"'Take your clothes off first,' I said helpfully. "'We don't want to have to burn them, do we?'
Chapter 26 Plague and Pestilence. I left the house just before sunset to check on my patient in the corn crib. He was no better, but neither was he visibly worse. The same laboured breathing and burning fever. This time, though, the sunken eyes met mine when I entered the shed, and stayed on my face as I examined him. He still had the raven's feather amulet clutched in his hand. I touched it and smiled at him, then gave him a drink. He still would take no food, but had a little milk, and swallowed without protest another dose of my febrifuge. He lay motionless through examination and feeding, but as I was wringing out a hot cloth to poultice his chest, he suddenly reached out a hand and grabbed my arm. He thumped his chest with his other hand and made an odd humming noise. This puzzled me for a moment, until I realized that he was humming.
"Really?" I said.
I reached for the packet of poulticing herbs and folded them into the cloth.
"Well, all right then, let me think."
I settled on Onward Christian Soldiers, which he appeared to like. I was obliged to sing it through three times before he seemed satisfied, and sank back on his blanket with a small spate of coughing, wrapped in camphor fumes. I paused outside the house, cleansing my hands carefully with a bottle of alcohol I carried. I was sure I was safe from contagion. I had had measles as a child, but wanted to take no chance of infecting anyone else.
"There was talk of an outbreak of the red measles in Cross Creek," Lord John remarked upon my reporting to Jamie the condition of our guest. "Is it true, Mrs. Fraser, that the savage is congenitally less able to withstand infection than our Europeans, while African slaves are yet more hardy than their masters?"
"Depends on the infection," I said, peering into the cauldron and giving the stew bottle a cautious poke. "The Indians are a lot more resistant to the parasitic diseases, malaria, say, caused by organisms here, and the Africans deal better with things like dengue fever, which came with them from Africa, after all. But the Indians haven't much resistance to European plagues like smallpox and syphilis, no." Lord John looked a bit taken aback, which gave me a small sense of satisfaction. Evidently he had only asked out of courtesy. He hadn't actually expected me to know anything.
"How fascinating," he said, though sounding truly interested. "You refer to organisms. Do you then subscribe to Mr. Evan Hunter's theory of miasmatical creatures?"
Now it was my turn to be taken aback.
Not precisely, no, I said, and changed the subject.
We passed a pleasant enough evening, Jamie and Lord John exchanging anecdotes of hunting and fishing, with remarks on the amazing abundance of the countryside, while I darned stockings. Willie and Ian had a game of chess, which the latter won to his evident satisfaction. His lordship yawned hugely, then catching his father's minatory eye, made a belated attempt to cover his mouth. He relaxed into a sleepy smile of contentment, brought on by repletion. He and Ian between them had demolished an entire currant cake following their huge supper. Jamie saw it, and cocked a brow at Ian, who obligingly rose and towed his lordship away to share his palate in the herb shed. "Two down," I thought, keeping my eyes resolutely away from the bed, "and three to go." In the event, the delicate problem of bedtime was solved by my retiring, cloaked in modesty, or at least in my nightgown, while Jamie and Lord John took over the chess table, drinking the last of the brandy by firelight. Lord John was a much better chess player than I, or so I deduced from the fact that the game took them a good hour. Jamie could normally beat me in 20 minutes flat. The play was mostly silent, though with brief spurts of conversation. At last, Lord John made a move, sat back and stretched, as though concluding something.
"I collect you will not see much disturbance in the political way, here in your mountain refuge," he said casually.
He squinted at the board, considering.
"I do envy you, Jamie, removed from such petty difficulties as afflict the merchants and gentry of the lowlands. If your life has its hardships, as cannot help but be the case, you have not the inconsiderable consolation of knowing your struggles to be significant and heroic."
Jamie snorted briefly.
"Oh, aye, very heroic, to be sure. At the moment, my most heroic struggle is like to be with the pig in my pantry."
He nodded toward the board, one eyebrow raised.
"You really mean to make that move?"
Grey narrowed his eyes at Jamie, then looked down, studying the board with pursed lips.
"Yes, I do," he answered firmly. "Damn," said Jamie, and with a grin reached out and tipped over his king in resignation.
Grey laughed and reached for the brandy bottle.
"Damn," he said in turn, finding it empty.
Jamie laughed, and rising went to the cupboard.
"Try a bit of this," he said,
and I heard the musical glug of liquid into a cup. Grey lifted the cup to his nose, inhaled, and sneezed explosively, scattering droplets over the table.
"It's not wine, John," Jamie observed mildly. "You're meant to drink it, eh? Not savour the bouquet." "So I noticed. Christ, what is it?"
Grey sniffed again, more cautiously, and essayed a trial sip. He choked, but swallowed gamely.
"Christ," he said again.
His voice was hoarse. He coughed, cleared his throat, and set the cup gingerly on the table, eyeing it as though it might explode.
"Don't tell me," he said. "Let me guess. It's meant to be Scotch whisky." "In 10 years or so it might be," Jamie answered, pouring a small cupful for himself.
He took a small sip, rolled it around his mouth, and swallowed, shaking his head.
"At the moment it's alcohol, and that's as much as I'd see for it. Yeah, I've 12 barrels of the stuff."
Grey's fair brows shot up at that.
"Assuming that you don't mean to clean your boots with it, may I ask what you intend doing with 12 barrels of this?"
Jamie laughed.
"Trade it," he said. "Sell it when I can. Customs tax and a license to brew spirits being one of the petty political concerns with which I am not afflicted, owing to our remoteness," he added ironically.
Lord John grunted, tried another sip, and set the cup down.
"Well, you may well escape the customs, I'll grant you. The nearest agent is in Cross Creek. But I cannot say I think it a safe practice on that account. To whom, may I ask, are you selling this remarkable concoction? Not to the savages, I trust.
Jamie shrugged.
Only very small amounts. A flask or two at a time, as a gift or in trade. Never more than would make one man drunk.
Very wise. You'll have heard the stories, I expect. I spoke with one man who'd survived the massacre at Michilimackinac during the war with the French. That was caused, in part at least, by a great quantity of drink falling into the hands of a large gathering of Indians at the fort.
I've heard about it, too, Jamie assured him dryly. But we are on good terms with the Indians nearby, and there are none so many of them as all that. And I'm careful, as I see.
He essayed another sip and grimaced.
I expect you risk more by poisoning one of them than by intoxicating a mob.
He set the glass down and changed the subject.
I have heard talk in Wilmington of an unruly group of men called Regulators who terrorize the back country and cause disruption by means of riot. Have you encountered anything of such nature here?
Jamie snorted briefly.
Terrorize what? Squirrels? There is the back country, John, and then there is the wilderness. Surely you will have remarked the lack of human habitation on your journey here. I did notice something of the kind, Lord John agreed, and yet I had heard certain rumours regarding your presence here, that it was in part meant as a quelling influence upon the growth of lawlessness.
Jamie laughed.
I think it will be some time before there is much lawlessness for me to quell. Though I did go so far as to knock down an old German farmer who was abusing a young woman at the grain mill on the river. He had it in mind she'd given him short wheat, which she had not, and I couldn't convince him otherwise. But that is my only attempt so far at maintaining public order.
Grey laughed and picked up the fallen king.
I'm relieved to hear it. Will you redeem your honour with another game? I cannot expect the same trick to work twice, after all.
I rolled onto my side, facing the wall, and stared sleeplessly at the timbers. The firelight glimmered on the wing-shaped marks of the axe, running along the length of each log, regular as sand ripples on a beach. I tried to ignore the conversation going on behind me, to lose myself instead in the memory of Jamie hewing bark and squaring logs, of sleeping in his arms under the shelter of a half-built wall, feeling the house rise up around me and closing me in warmth and safety, the permanent embodiment of his embrace. I always felt safe and soothed by this vision, even when I was alone on the mountain, knowing I was protected by the house he'd built for me. Tonight, though, it wasn't working. I lay still, wondering exactly what was the matter with me. Or rather, not what, but why. I knew by now what it was, all right. It was jealousy. I was indeed jealous, an emotion I hadn't felt for some years, and was appalled to feel now. I rolled onto my back and closed my eyes, trying to shut out the murmur of conversation. Lord John had been nothing but courtesy itself to me. More than that, he had been intelligent, thoughtful, thoroughly charming, in fact. And listening to him, making intelligent, thoughtful, charming conversation with Jamie, knotted my insides and made me clench my hands under cover of the quilt. "You're an idiot," I told myself savagely. "What is the matter with you?" I tried to relax, breathing deeply through my nose, eyes closed. Part of it was Willie, of course. Jamie was very careful, but I had seen his expression when he looked at the boy in unguarded moments. His whole body was suffused with shy joy, pride mingled with diffidence, and it smote me to the heart to see it. He would never look at Brianna, his firstborn, that way, would never see her at all. That was hardly his fault, and yet it seemed so unfair. At the same time, I could scarcely begrudge him his joy in his son. And it didn't, I told myself firmly. The fact that it gave me a terrible pang of longing to look at the boy with that bold, handsome face that mirrored his sister's was simply my problem.
Nothing to do with Jamie, or with Willie, or with John Gray, who'd brought the boy here.
What for?
That was what I'd been thinking ever since I'd recovered from the first shock of their appearance, and that was still what I was thinking.
What in hell was the man up to?
The story about the estate in Virginia might be true, or only an excuse. Even if it was true, it was a considerable detour to come to Fraser's Ridge. Why had he taken so much trouble to bring the boy here? And so much risk? Willie was clearly oblivious to the resemblance that even Ian had noticed. But what if he hadn't been? Had it been so important to Gray to restate his claim on Jamie's obligation to him? I rolled on to my other side and cracked an eyelid, watching them over the chessboard, red head and fair head bent together in absorption. Gray moved a knight and sat back, rubbing the back of his neck, smiling to himself at the effect of his move. He was a good-looking man, slight and fine-boned, but with a strong, clear-cut face and a beautiful, sensitive mouth that many a woman had no doubt envied. Gray was even better at guarding his face than Jamie was. I hadn't yet seen an incriminating look from him. I'd seen one once, though, in Jamaica, and wasn't in any doubt about the nature of his feelings for Jamie. On the other hand, I wasn't in any doubt about Jamie's feelings in that regard either. The knot under my heart eased a bit, and I took a deeper breath. No matter how late they sat up over the board, drinking and talking, it would be my bed Jamie came to. I unclenched my fists, and it was then, as I rubbed my palms covertly against my thighs, that I realized with a shock just why Lord John affected me so strongly. My fingernails had dug small crescents in my palms, a small line of throbbing half-moons. For years I had rubbed away those crescents after every dinner party, every late night when Frank had worked at the office. For years I had lain intermittently alone in a double bed, wide awake in the darkness, nails digging into my hands, waiting for him to come back. And he had. To his credit, he always did return before dawn. Sometimes to a back curled against him in cold reproach. Sometimes to the furious challenge of a body thrust against him in demand, urging him wordlessly to deny it, to prove his innocence with his body. Trial by combat. More often than not, he accepted the challenge. But it didn't help. Yet neither of us spoke of such things in the daylight. I couldn't. I had no right. Frank did not. He had revenge. Sometimes it would be months, even a year or more, between episodes, and we would live in peace together. But then it would happen again, the silent phone calls, the two excused absences, the late nights. Never anything so overt as another woman's perfume or lipstick on his collar. He had discretion. But I always felt the ghost of the other woman, whoever she was, some faceless, indistinguishable she. I knew it didn't matter who it was. There were several of them. The only important thing was that she was not me. And I would lie awake and clench my fists, the marks of my nails a small crucifixion. The murmur of conversation by the fire had mostly ceased, the only sound the small click of the chessmen as they moved.
"Do you feel yourself content?" Lord John asked suddenly.
Jamie paused for a moment.
"I have all that man could want," he said quietly. "A place and honourable work. My wife at my side. The knowledge that my son is safe and well cared for."
He looked up then at Gray.
"And a good friend."
He reached over, clasped Lord John's hand, and let it go.
"I want no more."
I shut my eyes resolutely and began to count sheep. I was awakened just before dawn by Ian crouching by my bedside.
"Auntie,"
he said softly, a hand on my shoulder.
"Best you come. The man in the corn crib's very poorly."
I was on my feet by reflex, wrapped in my cloak and moving barefooted after Ian before my mind had even begun to function consciously. Not that any great diagnostic skill was needed. I could hear the deep rattling respirations from 10 feet away. The Earl hovered by the doorway, his thin face pale and scared in the grey light. "Go away," I told him sharply. "You mustn't be near him, nor you, Ian. The two of you go to the house, fetch me hot water from the cauldron, my box, and clean rags." Willie moved away at once, eager to be away from the frightening sounds coming from the shed. Ian lingered, though, his face troubled.
"I dunno think you can help him, Auntie,"
he said quietly. His eyes met mine straight on with an adult depth of understanding. "Very likely not," I said, answering him in the same terms. "But I can't do nothing." He took a deep breath, nodded.
"Aye, but I think..."
He hesitated, then went on as I nodded.
"I think you shouldn't torment him with medicine. He's fixed to die, Auntie. We heard an owl in the night. He will have heard it too. It's a sign of death to them."
I glanced at the dark oblong of the door, biting my lip. The breaths were shallow and wheezing, with alarmingly long pauses between them. I looked back at Ian. "What do the Indians do when someone is dying? Do you know?"
"Sing," he said promptly.
"The shaman puts paint upon her face and sings the soul away to safety, so the demons dinna take it."
I hesitated, my instincts to do something at war with my conviction that action would be futile. Had I any right to deprive this man of peace in his dying? Worse, to alarm him into fear that his soul would be lost by my interference. Ian hadn't waited for the results of my dithering. He stooped and scraped up a small clot of earth, spat in it, and stirred it to mud. Without comment, he dipped his forefinger into the puddle and drew a line from my forehead down the bridge of my nose.
"Ian!"
"Shh,"
he murmured, frowning in concentration.
"Like this, I think."
He added 2 lines across each cheekbone and a rough zigzag down the left side of my jawbone.
"That's as near as I remember the proper way of it. I've only seen it the once, and from a distance."
"Ian, this isn't..."
"Shh,"
he said again, laying a hand on my arm to quell protest.
"Go to him, Auntie. You willna frighten him. He's accustomed to you, no?"
I rubbed away a drip from the end of my nose, feeling thoroughly idiotic. There was no time to argue, though. Ian gave me a small push, and I turned to the door. I stepped into the darkness of the corn crib, bent and laid a hand on the man. His skin was hot and dry, his hand limp as worn leather.
"Ian, can you talk to him? Say his name. Tell him it's all right."
"You mustn't say his name, Auntie. It will call demons."
Ian cleared his throat and said a few words in soft clicking gutturals. The hand in mine twitched slightly. My eyes had adjusted now. I could see the man's face, marked with a faint look of surprise as he saw my mud paint.
"Sing, Auntie,"
Ian urged, low-voiced.
"Tantum ergo, maybe. It sounded a wee bit like that."
There was nothing else I could do, after all. Rather helplessly, I began.
"Tantum ergo sacramentum."
Within a few seconds, my voice steadied, and I sat back on my bare heels, singing slowly, holding his hand. The heavy brows relaxed, and a look of what I thought might be calm came into the sunken eyes. I had been present at a good many deaths, from accident, warfare, illness, or natural causes, and had seen men meet death in many ways, from philosophical acceptance to violent protest. But I had never seen one die quite this way. He simply waited, eyes on mine, until I had come to the end of the song. Then he turned his face toward the door, and as the rising sun struck him, he left his body without the twitch of a muscle or the drawing of a final breath. I sat quite still, holding the limp hand, until it occurred to me that I was holding my breath too. The air around me seemed queerly still, as though time had stopped for a moment. But of course it had, I thought, and forced myself to draw breath. It had stopped for him, forever.
What are we going to do with him?
There was nothing further to be done for our guest. The only question at the moment was how we might deal best with his mortal remains. I had had a quiet word with Lord John, and he had taken Willie to gather late strawberries on the ridge. While the Indian's death had had nothing even faintly gruesome about it, I could wish Willie hadn't seen it. It wasn't a sight for a child who had seen his mother die no more than a few months before. Lord John had seemed upset himself. Perhaps a little sunshine and fresh air would help both of them. Jamie frowned and rubbed a hand over his face. He hadn't shaved yet, and the stubble made a rasping sound.
We must give him decent burial, surely. Well, I don't suppose we can leave him lying about in the corn crib.
But would his people mind if we buried him here? Do you know anything about how they treat their dead, Ian?
Ian was still a little pale, but surprisingly self-possessed. He shook his head and took a drink of milk.
I dinna ken a great deal, auntie. But I have seen one man die, as I told you. They wrapped him in a deerskin and had a procession round the village singing, and took the body a ways into the wood and put it up on a platform above the ground and left it there to dry.
Jamie seemed less than enthralled at the prospect of having mummified bodies perched in the trees near the farm.
I should think it best maybe to wrap the body decently and carry it to the village then, so his own folk can deal with him properly.
No, you can't do that. I slid the pan of newly baked muffins out of the Dutch oven, plucked a broom twig, and stuck it into one plump brown cake. It came out clean, so I set the pan on the table, then sat down myself. I frowned abstractedly at the jug of honey glowing gold in the late morning sun. The trouble is that the body is almost certainly still infectious.
You didn't touch him at all, did you, Ian?
I glanced at Ian, who shook his head, looking sober.
No, auntie. Not after he fell sick here. Before that, I didn't recall. We were all together hunting.
And you haven't had measles?
Drat.
I rubbed a hand through my hair. Have you? I asked Jamie. To my relief, he nodded.
Aye, when I was 5 or so. And you say a person canna have the same sickness twice, so it will not injure me to touch the body.
No, nor me either. I've had them too. The thing is, we can't take him to the village. I don't know at all how long the measles virus, that's a sort of germ, can live on clothes or in a body. But how could we explain to his people that they mustn't touch him or go near him? And we can't risk letting them be infected.
What troubles me, Ian put in unexpectedly, is that he isn't a man from Anauka. He's from a village further north. If we bury him here in the usual way, his folk may hear of it and think we had done him to death in some fashion, and buried him to hide it.
That was a sinister possibility that hadn't occurred to me, and I felt as though a cold hand had been laid on the back of my neck.
You don't think they would, surely?
Ian shrugged, broke open a hot muffin, and drizzled honey over the steaming insides.
Na cogna Weto's folk trust us, but Myers did say there were plenty who would not. They've reason to be suspicious, aye?
Considering that the bulk of the Tuscarora had been exterminated in a vicious war with the North Carolina settlers no more than 50 years before, I rather thought they had a point.
It didn't help with the present problem, though.
Jamie swallowed the last of his muffin and sat back with a sigh.
Well, then, I think we'd best wrap the poor man in a shroud of sorts and put him in the wee cave in the hill above the house. I've set the posts for a stable across the opening already. Those will keep the beasts off. Then Ian or I should go to Anauka and explain matters to Na Cogna Weto.
Perhaps he will send someone back who can look at the body and assure the man's people that he met with no violence from us. And then we can bury him.
Before I could reply to this suggestion, I heard footsteps running.